Good evening. Hello, hello, hello. I didn't pay him to say any of that, I promise. And I just think it's wonderfully ironic that the lady who's doing the talk on baking, her last name has slice in it. I mean, anyone else heard that?
Yeah.
Vander Slice in the title? I mean, that's actually awesome. All right, so today we're going to talk about the future of work. And I learned quickly that those who think they know the future are probably wrong. So I'll start with some humility. I don't know the future. I don't know what the future is going to look like. I like to think of the future as a stranger, someone you haven't met yet. And then also, speaking about work, Friday after 5, I made a rule when I started working that that should not be done. So I'm going to break that rule tonight. And my apologies to you for talking about work on a Friday after 5 when everyone is getting away from work. Right? I learned also quickly when you started working, like it's no one likes Mondays. I forgot a case of the Mondays. Mm-hmm. Then everybody gets excited on Wednesdays. It's hump day. And then we all thank goodness it's Friday. We have 2 days off to just do it all over again and get a case of the Mondays. Right? So if that's your reality, we can thank goodness it's Friday, and we'll talk a little bit about work. All right, so as I was preparing for this, I started thinking about my first day at work. So as Josh said, I work for a company called Pratt & Whitney. We make airplane engines. So I grew up in D.C., the D.C. area, and I moved to Connecticut to come work for Pratt & Whitney. I still remember the day I left. I moved on August 1st, 2009. And I started work August 3rd, 2009. And I woke up on August 3rd. I, took a shower like most people should do when you wake up in the morning. And then I went to orientation, got my badge, and I started thinking as well, like, you got that badge, and that badge so quickly becomes your identity, right? Because, like, on Wednesday, you know, when you're walking around at lunch, you just are seeing everyone's badge, and it's almost like this is what we do now. We're all working and have jobs. So, and then we have two plants for Pratt & Whitney. So I went to my orientation, and then I drove now to Middletown, Connecticut for my first official day on the job. I walked in, I saw a cubicle. It was 4 seats in the cubicle, and I sat right here on the right. There was someone sitting here, and then 2 guys behind me. And I quickly realized that none of these people were anything like me. So the guy on the left, it was a middle-aged gentleman that was going through a divorce. Why do I know that? Because every morning when I would come in, he would be arguing profusely with his ex-wife on the phone, loudly in our cubicle. Right? I know his first wife's name. I know how many children they have, all because as I would come to work in the morning to sit down at my desk and begin to design sprockets, I would hear probably too much about this gentleman's life. And the guy diagonal to me, he was about 3 or 4 years older than me, grew up in Worcester, Mass, and we tried to have a conversation the first day that lasted about 30 seconds, and we quickly knew that we had nothing in common with each other. And then the guy directly behind me, he was also a middle-aged guy, and no exaggeration, was probably the nerdiest person I've ever seen in real life, right? So he actually wore a pocket protector. I saw it on television. I didn't know if it was real, but he actually had pens and pencil in his pocket, right? He had his shirt tucked in, but it was like, you know, halfway tucked in, halfway out. And he talked a million miles a minute, and he just had so much to say. And I remember turning around after I met all these characters and had orientation, and I said, wow, I guess this is work, right? I guess this is work. And then I started to think of all the things I heard growing up about, like, joining the rat race, right? And I was like, I'm not sure if I wanted to join this rat race, right? And then I said, you know, wow, maybe the rest of my life I have to look forward to coming and greeting these wonderful human beings and trying to climb the corporate ladder. We have like mantras that we tell ourselves as we enter the workforce, right? And then I also, on my first day at work, so I graduated college in 2009, and apparently 2008 and 9 was one of the worst recessions we had ever seen. And the company actually had a hiring freeze, right? So I didn't know that the company had a hiring freeze until, like, I was, like, the new guy around. People started kind of looking at me weirdly. And then one person just asked, well, how did you get here? I'm like, that's a weird question. I mean, like, yeah, I don't know to say out, how did you get here, you know? Like, and so he just kind of let me know, well, we have a hiring freeze. And then I started, you know, thinking, it's like, I was talking to my friend Obi yesterday, and we were saying, we came out of college, and we didn't even know what a recession really meant, right? Because we don't have any idea of how much milk cost 30 years ago. We didn't buy it, right? We don't know, you know, the price of filling your gas tank, and that, you know, the prices are going up. We didn't feel it. So it's like you're just kind of coming into this world that they call work, and you just kind of, maybe it's a baptism by fire. And I started to quickly think, is this really going to be the rest of my life? And I started thinking about the paradox of work, right? Because it's, on the one hand, now that I have my badge of honor, you know, that I have a job, there's some sense of, you know, happiness and pride. And because there was a recession, apparently, you know, a lot of my friends were, they were struggling to find jobs. And, you know, I got a job. I moved out of my parents' house. So on one hand, you're happy, right? And like, it's like the paradox of work is, on the one hand, as much as we may like watching Netflix, after watching 10 hours of Netflix, you're not necessarily proud of that, right? But sometimes when you come home from work after doing a hard day's work, or, you know, you get some good success or some fruit in your work, you're proud of that in a way that you're probably not proud of watching 10 hours of Netflix, right? And then I also started listening on the job to the ways we complain about work. Right? And like, people would say things like, you only got 45 more years left. And like, with like a smug smile of like, you know, welcome to the rest of your life. You know, and like one of my coworkers actually had like a countdown to retirement by the day. Right? And like, every day he would like rip it off. And it was just coming into this world, I just really was like, what is going on? Is this what work is? And then you're struggling to, I wouldn't say, try to find some meaning and make sense of what it is you're actually doing, right? And so once you, you know, after the first 3 months, when you figure out where the bathroom is, you figure out, you know, how to get to work, you figure out what time you should probably go to sleep so that you can actually get to work on time and not be tired. Once you figure that stuff out, it's like, wait a second, I have something to do, right? And like, what is that, you know, for me to do? And so I just kind of took all these things as what I started to quickly try to figure out, what is actually going on? And I started calling it for myself the paradox of work. And then I was living in England last year, and I was in England for Brexit, and I was in America for the election of President Trump. And on both sides, being in England and being in America, right, the questions of the economy and jobs and dislocation and technology coming and eating away jobs, technology leaving certain people behind, people, you know, there being a stratified society now, and all these things, I feel like I lived through it twice in real time, right? And because I was in both places. And then this again started to really bring the question of what is actually really going on. You have, you know, all types of articles and pundits saying so many different types of things. It was like we're getting inundated with all these thoughts of what's actually going on, and then trying to find some real clarity within that. So today, hopefully, we will talk about three main things: the current landscape of work, some biblical reflections on work, and if there's time, the dangers of consumerism and marketing. I don't want to overpromise. We might not get to the third one. So if that's what you're really looking for, as Josh said, some shameless marketing, we'll have a part two. Right? So I'll say quickly some trends affecting, you know, work and jobs. And I'll say three things: technology, aging, and urbanization and or globalization. So getting ready for this, two books that were very, very helpful, right? The first one was called No Ordinary Disruption, and it was three guys who've been working globally for McKinsey, and they said that what's happening in the world right now is actually really unique, and there are, as the title says, no ordinary disruptions. These are different from what we've seen before, and they actually had four trends. I'm not going to include their fourth one, but these were I would say the three main ones that they were driving at in the book. And then there are two MIT professors that wrote a book called The Second Machine Age, Andrew McAvey and Eric Brynjolfsson. I know how to say that because I listened to him talk. He has a TED talk and I listened to a bunch of his talks and I always heard them pronounce his name. So it's Brynjolfsson. I almost know how to spell it because I've seen his name so much now. But, and so they wrote a book called The Second Machine Age, and these two books were really, really helpful to try to, figure out what's going on, right? So first, technology, right? A lot of people are arguing because on one hand we have record levels of GDP, productivity, and profits. And then on the other hand, median income is stagnating and or in a lot of cases dropping. So they're trying to, as they're looking at the economy, they're trying to figure out, okay, what exactly is going on when we have these two sides and how do we explain it? None of the economists actually agree on what the factors are or the driving factors, but all of them speak about technology. Right? On one hand, you have technology has been removing jobs, adding jobs, and changing jobs for probably the beginning of man. Right? A lot of them point out in 1900, 40% of Americans worked on farms. Now today in 2017, it's less than 2%. Right, and that a lot of that has been driven by technological advances. A lot of people point out that, you know, horses. When's the last time you've seen one of them? Right, maybe this is a more rural place in America. Right, you might run into a horse. When I was in England, I went to a village in England, and I actually saw a horse on the road, and I freaked out. Like, where in the world am I right now? Like it was like, and no one else was freaking out. That's why I said, okay, we have a problem. There's a horse on the road. Everyone else was kind of relaxing. But, you know, again, you know, technology has, you know, in many ways come and made horses obsolete in society. And so technology has been coming in, removing jobs. But then people argue it removes jobs, it changes jobs, but it also adds jobs. So that the big question now is, are we at a tipping point where technology is removing jobs and not adding enough jobs? And there was another professor, David Auder. He's also at MIT. And the way that he explains it and looks at it is he says that it's kind of like a dumbbell, right? So you have low-end jobs and high-end jobs and median-end jobs, right? So low-end jobs, he kind of explains, are people like barbers or gardeners, or there's a lot of manual labor involved, right? He'll say, you know, middle-skilled jobs are like tax preparers, maybe receptionists and people along those lines. And he talks about high-end jobs where there is like high-tech jobs that require a lot of education. And so he explains it as a dumbbell because what's actually going on in the economy is on the low end, right? Technology is not necessarily coming in and removing those jobs because they're not routine tasks. And it's really hard for technology to remove jobs that don't have routine tasks. And then on the high end jobs, a lot of times because it takes a lot of abstract thinking, right? It's hard to create technology to remove those jobs because you need humans to do the abstract thinking. So a lot of times in those jobs, technology comes and it assists. But then in the middle, those are the jobs where have been removed the most, have been made obsolete, and that are gone because there's a lot of routine tasks that are repeatable and codifiable. So what we actually see going on is we see this. Right, so this comes from a 2013 study done through Oxford University. And what they predicted was they looked at 700 jobs in the U.S. economy, and they said 47% of those jobs are highly susceptible to automation. And as you can see, right, as they broke it out, most of it comes right there in the middle. Right, and then all those colors are, I guess, explaining the industries that those jobs are in, and they're kind of showing you across on a scale of 0 to 1, you know, how much susceptible to automation your job is per their analysis, right? And so that's how I would say most of the economists come to explain, okay, what's actually going on in society as far as technology goes. Right? And then again, like we said, they really stress on the kinds of jobs that technology can come and eat away. It's mostly routine jobs, but they argue, David Autor, he has a TED Talk that's out now, that and the title of it is, Why Are There Still So Many Jobs? Right? So he kind of goes in and begins to explain one of these things as it comes to technology. And then many argue when it comes to technology that we're at essentially the speed and the scale of technology is moving. This comes from the book No Ordinary Disruption, and they're breaking out saying that the speed that technology is taking is just moving from like they're saying from the first phone calls to the first website to the first iPhone, right? And with the internet, with 3D printing, with advanced robotics, the speed that technology is taking is going really fast. And they're also showing that people accepting technology being adapted is also at record speed, right? They're saying it took 38 years. I think this was to reach 50 million users for the radio, 13 years for the television, 4 years, there's 50 million users for the iPod, 3 years on the internet. In one year, Facebook got 50 million users, and then Twitter got it in 9 months, right? So the it's being adapted at record speeds as well. And as well, they're saying with the economy, there is the bounty and the spread of how technology is shifting the way that things are done. When we say bounty, what do we mean? That it's, like I started off saying, there's record levels of production, record levels of GDP. So technology is increasing how much money people can make, right? If you think about it, think about TurboTax, right? Before, there was a lot of tax preparers, but now you can take the routine tax that is done, and you can create a software called TurboTax and sell it for $39.99. So what that does is, the creators of TurboTax, it creates winner-take-all markets, right? So now, the one that created it is a very, very wealthy man. He creates this market, all the tax preparer jobs go away, everyone starts using TurboTax, but everyone's paying $39.99. And so you don't necessarily need to employ a lot of people, right? You create something that is helping people, and, you know, he takes all the bounty, the money that's created. Or you can use Kodak and Instagram, for example, right? So Instagram, let's see if I have the numbers here for Instagram. Before I lose them. So anyone heard of Instagram before? If you haven't, raise your hand. Shame on you. So Instagram, for those that don't know, is another social media platform. It's a way that you can, it's solely for pictures, and it's transformed to videos, and there's some like live stories now on Instagram. So Instagram, they had 4,600 employees versus Kodak that had over 100,045 employees. And Kodak was in business for 132 years. Facebook recently, it's not recently anymore, but Facebook buys Instagram for $1 billion. The creators of Instagram get rich. And if you can focus on the number of employees it took to create an Instagram, sell it, get that much money. And so that's 4,600 people with an Instagram kind of get paid out and have jobs through Facebook versus 143,000 through Kodak, right? So technology comes in. It's not that people aren't taking pictures. It's not that people aren't, you know, enjoying Instagram, but it's that with technology, there's the bounty and the spread. So the bounty, Instagram is very, very rich, probably richer than Kodak ever was, right? And so like they create a lot of money, but it just goes to that small portion, and then the spread, it doesn't necessarily trickle down to the rest of us because we can see as far as the job creation. So technology, you can use really, really small teams. You're not necessarily employing a lot of people. So technology is coming in, and the way that it's, I would say, disrupting things is mainly with this bounty and spread. So there's still a lot of economic prosperity, but it's just not going, it's not spreading out. And so a lot of people now with this technology, they're, like we said, dislocation as far as jobs and as far as inequality goes, right? So you have winner-take-all markets where the top there create superstars and the winners are taking all the money, and it's not necessarily going to everyone else. And through that, what that creates now with bounty and spread, I think, is what a lot of the things that we're seeing now in kind of what technology is doing. Yes. So then now when you turn to jobs, the types of jobs that technology is creating, it's creating lots of STEM jobs, and it's not necessarily creating that middle jobs as we were saying before, but it's not removing the lower end jobs, right? And so you can see this are the graduation rates. It's creating a jobs gap, right? These are the graduation rates of people graduating within STEM fields, in what they call advanced economies. This is the 2008 class, right? Then what they are predicting now is, as you can see by the title, the world is likely to have too few high-skilled workers and not enough jobs for the low-skilled workers, right? So there's just a gap between supply and demand for as far as the types of jobs that are being created and required for. And there's been plenty of articles that I've seen now that are essentially highlighting this. And one of the very interesting things that I've found is a lot of articles are highlighting, well, what has happened to men? Because they're saying, you know, the people that are feeling the dislocation the most are men as they're going through and they're looking at the numbers. The Industrial Revolution, for example, it, I'd say, changed a lot of things socially where females were entering into the workforce, and there was created a lot of prosperity. It created a lot of manufacturing jobs, but those types of jobs are disappearing. And what people are saying, as I don't know if you guys saw, they said there was articles maybe 2 months ago that were saying that we had fully rebound now and the employment rate had come back to the pre-recession rates. But then a lot of people say that's driven by they just stopped looking for jobs and they've fallen out of the workforce, not necessarily that the economy is creating new jobs and dynamism. People also are arguing that recessions and rebounds is what happens, right? That's what's been happening since, you know, the Great Depression. You know, the economy goes into a recession and it rebounds. It goes into a recession and it rebounds. It's somewhat cyclical. But they're pointing out that the difference now being, since the recession in 2008, it took until 2014 to rebound. So the time it took was just that much longer. Right. So technology. Technology, I think I gave the example of the Luddites, right? And it's just been in society, changing society for a long time. But now the question comes, are we at a tipping point? Then the next point that people drive at is aging. Right, as you look at the numbers in most of the advanced economies, right, the elderly are living longer and there's just more of them. And then they've also pointed out that the birth rates, in order for you to maintain your societal numbers, the birth rate has to be above 2.1. And if you maintain a birth rate less than 2.1, your society begins to die off. And so in a lot of the advanced economies, I read a funny term. It was secular stagnation, right? So as economies advance and become more secular, they just stop having kids, right? And so, and there's, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. I think they were saying in like Eastern Europe and a lot of the Baltic places in the world, right? If the rates keep up, that they're going to reduce by like 40% by 2060, right? Because that's what's happening. There's just dislocation. And so as the world ages, especially in a lot of these advanced economies, there was a professor at MIT, Darren, I don't remember his last name, starts with an A, trust me on that. So we'll go with Darren for now. So he wrote a paper that was essentially looking at the effects of aging on the economy, right? Because again, people are looking at this and there's a paradox, right? They're saying, yes, people are living longer. Obviously, that's going to begin to drain social services because there's going to be more people dropping out of the workforce. There's going to be more people that are cashing in their retirement, their benefits, and there are less people going into the workforce. Right? So how are these economies maintaining their production levels? Right? And then again, the sneaky guy technology comes back in. So now a lot of people are arguing that we actually need technology and automation to just keep up with the levels of production that we're seeing. Right? So, that's not the one. Here we go. So, as you can see in this chart, they're showing that the advanced economies, which were they're seeing the secular stagnation because of aging, those advanced economy people are aging, but then in the emerging economies, that's where they're still having children and secular stagnation has not exactly hit it yet. And so they're saying a lot of these advanced economies, it actually needs migration and technology to continue on with the same rates of production that is happening now. And then another problem that we see is youth unemployment. In a lot of the emerging economies and the advanced economies, there is youth unemployment. So their societies are aging, and a lot of the youth aren't joining the workforce, so it's almost like a perfect storm. And this is developed countries and emerging economies, right? The youth unemployment is a big problem, right? So we have technology, we have aging, and then we have globalization, or as I like to say, urbanization. Let me go back to this chart here. So now they're saying many emerging economies, China, India, and Brazil, I like to say they have emerged, right? There have been, because of production, because of education, a lot of these economies have risen. And because of urbanization, in a lot of these places, everyone is moving to cities. So you have large numbers of people that are moving to cities that have disposable income that can now buy goods. And so this has brought economic prosperity to a lot of other parts of the world. And companies have seen this because I think one of the issues with globalization is you have a global marketplace, but you don't have a global government. Right, so as people become more connected through technology, as it's easier to communicate, it's easier to send goods all around the world, and the people in these emerging economies are actually coming out of poverty. I think there was a stat that I read that there's been over 1 billion people that have been moved out of poverty around the world, where poverty meaning they just, the group of, the book actually called it the consuming class. I was highly troubled by that term, but for lack of a better term, we'll go with that. They call it the consuming class. Over 1 billion people have entered the consuming class around the world. So in emerging markets, as we said before, these they're not necessarily feeling the effects of aging yet because they have younger populations. And as you saw with the education slide, a lot of these emerging markets, they are studying STEM and they are studying a lot of these things. So it's just affecting globalization / urbanization. It's affecting essentially everything in the world. Also, they point out as these places urbanize, they need materials to kind of build up their industries. So now there's more stress on raw materials because you need the same materials. We see that build up cities and buildings and bridges and roads. And so now that's just needed all over the world. So they're seeing now this is kind of going now and affecting our environment because everyone is digging for all of these materials and, you know, people begin to become frightened. Will the cost of raw materials, will that begin to skyrocket because we have all these people all around the world wanting to move to cities. So you have globalization and urbanization, right? So as the book begins to sum up, these four, four trends are, affecting jobs and just affecting economies on a global scale now. So, let's see. Yeah, this was the what they're showing here. 3 billion people joining the consuming class between these times. So that's what I'd say is some of the trends that are affecting the economy, affecting jobs, the number of jobs created, affecting entrepreneurship, affecting bounty and spread, how much is getting created and how much is getting shared throughout the economy. And as I thought about that, I began to reflect on my experiences of work, and just as you kind of look around at what's going on in the world with work, I started asking myself critical questions on just, you know, work. What is it and how does it fit in societies, right? We need work, I would say, for our societies to flourish. There's an example of Youngstown, Ohio. Youngstown, Ohio, they said, was actually the richest city in the 50s. But then over, I think it was a two-year period, they lost over 1 million jobs. And an economist created a term, which was regional depression, right? So after they lost all those jobs, regional depression set in, suicide rates went up, spousal abuse, drug use went up. And then, ironically, you know, they used to produce steel. Then in the 90s, the only time that they started to create money was when they started using steel to build jails to see what was going on, right? So people are fearing, in a sense, Youngstown writ large in what's going on in the economy. But we need work to flourish as human beings. So I started asking myself the question, should we, in a sense, quote unquote, fight for work, right? Or advocate for work? Because at the same time, others are saying, well, this is great. Can technology take away the jobs we don't want to do, so maybe we can be free to do the things that we would like to do? Right? They're saying, come on, lots of jobs are horrible, right? Lots of jobs are rote and routine, and it's, and technology can help free us and liberate us to do the things that we would like to do. And so there's like some sort of a celebration. There's a group of scholars called the post-workist, and they're almost championing, yes, we should hail this on. You know, like, let's free ourselves from work, from this labor and from this toil. Right? So I think it just gave me pause to really think, how does work fit into the big picture of, you know, the human experience? And, you know, like, thinking through the paradox of work. And that's where it really pushed me to think about this biblically. Like, what does God say about work? And I started to reflect on that. And in Genesis 1:26, we're told that man was made in the image of God, right? And I think there was a, like a weekend. Was it that last term where you guys looked at the image of God? Was that the last term or the term before that?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Recently, in the last year.
Yes. Yes. So he has a man made in the image of God. And how I like to think about that is, in a sense, that we reflect God in, you know, certain ways. And the Bible depicts God, there's a metaphor used, like God is a worker, right? One of the main metaphors for God in the Bible is God is a potter, right? God is actually working away at the clay, right? So God is a worker. God is a shepherd. Jesus came into the world as a carpenter. Right, God is a gardener. He's a builder, an architect, even a musician. So we see human beings made in the image of God. You know, lots of ways, metaphors for God is us seeing God as a worker. We see in Genesis, God, he creates, he does his work of creation, and he says that it's good. Right? He gets some pleasure in working and in creating. Right, God is, he didn't just create, he's also the sustainer, right? So he creates the world, but then he's still involved. He's sustaining the world, right? So man made in the image of God and thinking about God as a worker. And then as you continue to reflect on the Genesis story, God creates man and he gives man something to do, right? He says to be fruitful and to multiply, right? He says that we should, you know, have dominion in the earth. Like he says that he puts them in the garden, and he doesn't till the ground for them. Right? He tells them to till the ground. So beginning to think through work. Work is necessary for human flourishing. And I think it's a great point to make that work was in the human story and in the fabric of creation before the fall. So then as the story continues, you have creation, right? And in creation, we see work. And then the fall of human beings, right? Work gets cursed in a sense. Like work becomes toilsome, right? You're going to work, but it's going to be toil. You're going to get thorns and thistles, right? So I think in my mind, as I was thinking through my first days at work and thinking through, I was told all my life to believe and achieve. And then they gave me a pencil and a cubicle, you know, and thinking about work, that this is a helpful framework to begin to think about it. Well, work is not necessarily bad. Work is a good, and work has it's deformed in a sense. It's not ruined, but it's not ruined. It's not completely horrible and bad in the ways where sometimes it's depicted to us. But it can be toilsome, and because it's been cursed. And then in Ecclesiastes, you see the writer of Ecclesiastes. He's essentially he's toiling or fighting with himself about work. Right? I think it's 2. I lost the place. But in Ecclesiastes. The writer of Ecclesiastes is essentially saying he's looking and he's trying to do something and he's saying that these things are vanity, right? He's saying in a sense, sometimes work can feel pointless. Like, what is the point of this, right? You can be in a job and it's drudgery and it's just not fun and you're not getting meaning from it or purpose from it, right? So I think work, you know, now in our reality can become pointless. Work can become fruitless at times as well. You're going to work and you feel like you're working very hard, but you're not necessarily reaping the fruits of it. You're not, it's not coming out as you want it. So as you're involved in trying to make something of the world and to do your work, right, there is something that is, I'd say people sense it internally that there's something that has gone wrong. Work becomes, it can become fruitless, it can become pointless, work can become toilsome. But I still think that work is a necessary thing for human flourishing. And as we start to put it in that framework of creation and then fall and redemption, I think that now there's still, as we read, continue on in the biblical story, the Bible tells us to work with our hands. The Bible speaks a lot against laziness and slothfulness and how we shouldn't... I think it says, my Sunday school teacher would be very angry with me right now. I can't read this verse. But I think it says I'm going to paraphrase. This is the Abba version. A lazy man shouldn't eat, right? Is it, that's, any Sunday school students? Good, there we go. Yeah. So there, thinking about work in that, creation, fall, redemption, I think is a very, very helpful way to think about the phenomenon that is work that we're all engaged with. And then also the idea of the Sabbath, because as I look around at a lot of my friends and just see them, there's a danger to workaholism, like people just work too much, right? Technology has actually quote unquote freed us to work all the time, anytime, and not have breaks. We go to sleep thinking about our work phones. We get phantom buzzes on our legs. Our bosses can get us at any time, anywhere. You can be on vacation. You just can't escape work, right? And so there's that equal danger, I feel like, of imbalances on both sides, not working hard enough and then working too much. But this biblical framework for work, I want to say, gives us the proper way to at least struggle for some balance and sanity, right? I go to New York a lot of times to see lots of my friends that are working and chasing a lot of different dreams and avenues to make a living, And I usually leave sad because this can't be life for you guys. You don't sleep. You're never in your house. Do you call your mother? Right, so. Right, so I firmly believe New Yorkers need prayer. But, yeah. So, this framework of man made in the image of God, God putting work in the garden, and work being a part of the fabric of humanity from the beginning, it being cursed and becoming toilsome, pointless sometimes, and fruitless. And then I think as well, work can begin to reveal a lot about us, right? Going back to that badge of honor as you get your badge for work. It can begin to reveal the things you really, really care about, right? When you begin to ask yourself, okay, why am I doing this? Why do I work? Is it only for money? Is it for some sense of prestige? Do I, quote unquote, want to make a difference in the world? And there's so many reasons why people, you know, come to work. Some people say that you just have to do it. It's practical. You have to get on with it, right? There's a Yale professor of management, Amy Wierzynski, and she says people work for three main reasons, right? She says it's, for some, it's just a job, just something that you need money, you have to survive. And she breaks it down next as career, where people get some sense of prestige. There's opportunities for advancement. And then the last one, she says, is calling. People get some sense of meaning from what they're doing. And so I think it's good to reflect on, why do we work? Why are we working? What are the motivations that, you know, push us to get out of bed in the morning? Do you find your work meaningful and fulfilling? Has technology affected your work? Right. And then this is the other question I thought for some reflection. Actually, I'm going to take a survey quickly in the room. Have you used or worked in the gig economy? The gig economy meaning you're paid for some gig on the side, like Uber or Lyft or TaskRabbit, or there's lots of other ways to be involved in this new gig economy that's emerging. Has anyone used or worked for the gig economy?
I have. Side jobs, does that count? No, it's got to be with like a...
Technology, come on, it's 2017. Have you used it or worked in it?
Like taken a lift.
Yes, before in your life. Anyone let's see? Okay, interesting. All right. You've used it.
Yes.
You've done it. You're on the list. How was your Airbnb experience? I don't work for them. It's fine.
It was better than some B&Bs out there.
Okay.
Much cheaper.
What?
Not being the back room part of the laundry.
Okay. Okay.
You said better?
Yeah. What city were you in?
We were out west.
Okay. All right. Cool. I'll report back to Airbnb and tell them about your experience. All right. So, as we continue with the future of work, these are just ways for me that I feel like now I almost feel commissioned to advocate for work as a good in our society. Like, we need work. And I was also reflecting on, should societies create avenues for people to engage in and to have meaningful work? Should that be the job of societies? Right? I think yes. I deeply think yes as well. Like, my family immigrated from Nigeria, and one of the constant complaints of my parents and a lot of the people in my parents' generation who came over from Nigeria was, we wanted to go back, but there was no jobs, right? So we essentially had no choice. what were we going to go back and do? Right? And so as I kind of think about that and that reality, it's in some way we are responsible for creating jobs and or just, you know, knowing where we are. And that, not that we should be Luddites and fight against technology, but in some way, I want to say just advocating or being for, I think we need employment. It's a part of what it means to be human. Like, we really deeply need that. Okay. I'll get off my work soapbox. I've lost myself in my notes. Sorry. All right. So then, moving forward, John Maynard Keynes, in 1915, he predicted that the problem of the future would be, what are we going to do with all of our leisure time? Because he thought that technology and compound interest would remove work and would free us. And people, people would work on average 15 hours a week, and our problems would be all of our abundant leisure time. Right? He was historically and emphatically wrong, but you know, that's how he saw the future of work going. And I think with the trends and with the biblical reflections on work, that's essentially my question to all of us here, right? As we look at these things, where do we see work going? And I think we have a lot of questions to really grapple with and think about. Where in the 1900s, when most people were working in agriculture and there was a switch from agriculture to where now 2% do that, that's when public high schools were created, where people realized that we need education. So at that time, they reformed education so that, you know, people can go to school and then people would be able to work, right? Are we at a tipping point now where there needs to be some thoughtful engagement with how people are educated? I think as well, there's been lots and lots of debate. We'll get into this more in part two. If there are large amounts of dislocation and unemployment, how are we going to take care of people within our society? How are we going to do that? There's no economic law that says if an abundance of bounty or money is created, that everybody gets a share of it, right? So how are we going to do that as we already see the trends going to dislocation, and we see the bounty and the spread, as inequality will probably grow? How should we or do we respond as a society, and what types of things should we be involved in creating work, creating jobs for other people? All right, so I think I will leave my remarks there, and we'll jump into a time of Q&A. And then for next time, I think what we'll probably do is go a little bit deeper into technology and AI and exactly the things that are happening as technology speeds ahead. And then we'll probably try to go into look a little bit more at education, and then we'll probably do the consumerism as well and what that is doing to the world and to our economies. So thank you very much for listening. So I think we go into a time of question and answer, and I think you don't have to stay. You're free to go if you have somewhere to be, but we'll stay and talk about work as long as you want to on a Friday night. All right. Any questions?
You had a slide that was up there, but I don't think you talked about migration.
Yeah.
And can you factor that into it? Because that's certainly been a major issue in this country. Well,
was it this one?
Yeah, Europe. I don't know. I'm not sure which, but it just was. It was there, and I thought you were going to talk about it. But it,
let's see.
How do you see migration?
Okay.
Major population migrations is. That solves a problem, but it's incredibly difficult for the people who do it. And
yeah.
People have been migrating for a long time.
Yeah.
Not many of us go back in this country for more than a few hundred years.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just wondered how you see that thing.
Well, I'm pessimistic and optimistic, right? So 2 days ago I listened to Professor John Gray at the London School of Economics, and he was essentially talking about the future of work, globalization, and migration. And what he was saying was, because of the growing economic depression, what usually happens is the people that are there revolt against the others. And so whatever you call or claim as other, that usually creates fragmentation within the society, and he was saying that that's almost the grave digger of globalization, is that as people come, as they engage in the economy at times of economic depression, the people that you call as other, there's tensions rise, and the people that are there usually revolt. So that was his view of things.
So the migration will stop, or will...
And he said that the migration will stop because globalization is inherently flawed, is what his view was. He was saying that as walls came down around the world, he said that we didn't take seriously enough how deep our differences were. And so he said that because there are actually deep differences and people want to just have their way of life, as people migrate across the world at these times of economic downturns, because we didn't take seriously how deep our differences were, we haven't actually learned to live together, so you'll just call somebody another, and then that's usually when tensions rise and break out. So that's what he says, that he called it the myth of globalization. People will probably start to wear off, right? So that was his take on it, and I can't really say that that's wrong, because I think we see that kind of happening around us, right? But to your point, I think what this slide is saying is that, hey, because of demographics, if we're going to remain at our same productivity levels, we really actually need migration. We need, you know, people to come in and work. And so it's almost like a catch-22, because you need to let people in to come in and do the work. And I think that's what spurred the migration to Europe and to America, was that, you know, we actually need people to come in and work and build a society. So those are my thoughts. Yeah?
So I studied mechatronics engineering for a year, just 2015. And it's interesting how different, like, we did not discuss these things. So maybe it's just because we were in the matter.
You said you studied what engineering?
Mechatronics. It's automation.
Okay.
Robotics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They glorified applying it.
Yeah.
I mean, mechanical, that's the...
Yeah, yeah.
It's glorified robotics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I actually got out of that program because I was disillusioned and not convinced that it was worth my life investment, you know,
okay,
my professional life.
Yeah.
To go for a cause that I wasn't convinced would be even healthy for civilization.
Yeah.
Also, when I was studying general chemistry, I was like a student assistant, I mean a teacher assistant, I don't know what to call it, but he was studying like electrical engineering at the University of Tennessee, and he was convinced that the electronics age is just the next evolution of man, And that's the survival of the fittest, and those of us who are smart enough to make the robots and control the robots will continue, and those who are the working class will cease to exist.
Yeah.
And I did not know how to engage a conversation with him when he was convinced that that's just part of the evolution of me.
Yeah. And I think to your point, what is fascinating in a lot of the literature is people's worldview usually comes out as they begin to try to explain what's happening. And so I think because a lot of professors in higher education, that is their worldview. A lot of them have a very smug view towards what's going on in the sense of, to your point, well, that's kind of just what happens. And what I found in a lot of the literature that I was reading is that a lot of them just champion it, and almost it's an unguided, you know, process of this is what where we're going now, this is where human beings are going. And I think the only way in my mind where I have found to engage that worldview is through asking questions, especially as we're seeing the dislocation in societies where like broader questions of, well, okay, what are human beings for at the end of the day? Right? So like, and like, what is the point? Or like, cause I think a lot of times because we don't ask those deeper questions of, you know, okay, this is a means, but what's the end? Right? And so I beginning to at least ask those questions, cause what I feel like is sometimes as I was reading and listening to people, I would listen, they would talk about it. And then one time, it was like an hour talk. And then the interviewer, what she says, you know, we've talked about the future of work and the dislocation of work. And we've talked about it, you know, in, you know, like economic terms and these terms. And then she goes, what do you think it will do to society? And all these smart PhDs are where they were like, one of them was like, oh, no, I never thought about it. I was like, okay. And then like another one was like, people will figure it out. Human beings are, you know, have ingenuity, right? So it's like, I think the undergirded worldview comes out in how people reason and put these things together. So I think one, asking questions, and then two, trying to show another way that might be more beautiful, right? Because it's, yeah. Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's what I think.
But you touched on something that's actually a very sore point with me, so forgive me if I start to ramble. But you mentioned that societies having very different ideals and very different ways of organizing society. Now, I work in IT for UTC, and in IT, essentially what we've done is we have opened the door and unified our labor market with India.
Yep.
And American society and American ideals are very different from Indian society and Indian ideals. And allowing India to just do their thing and run their economy their way and compete with us, I mean, I've told people it's like having a, quote, football game between Manchester United and Pittsburgh Steelers, each team playing by its own rules. And that's what it is. It's like letting a boxer, one boxer has boxing gloves, and you let somebody in with, instead of boxing gloves, they have brass knuckles.
Yeah.
And you have Americans where almost everybody, virtually everybody, practically everybody goes to high school. Practically everybody has a toilet. Practically everybody has a refrigerator. That costs money. And if you're running a company in the United States, that cost of everybody going to high school and having a refrigerator and having electricity and running water is borne by your company. You open the door to a country where 95% of the people don't have a high school education or a refrigerator or running water or electricity, it's cheap to run a business that way. It's cheap to run a modern, prosperous country the size of Belgium inside a desperately poor, insanely oppressed country the size of India, which eventually falls under the rubric of what could go wrong. But we opened it to that, and we say, this is great, this is equal. So now I find myself in my work group. I am now the only person in my work group who was born and educated in the United States. I am the only native English speaker in my work group. And I've just gotten used to it, so I'm not complaining about that, but you play by totally different rules, mm-hmm. and then open up the game and say, well, that's competition.
And so I think that on a lot of levels, that's just kind of where we are and where we've come to as the world. And I'm trying to frame my remarks. I'm trying to think. If anyone has anything else to say, please, you know, jump in. Go ahead.
If you have these, you know, maybe millions of people who, where they don't have electricity or the toilets or whatever,
yeah.
And they, because of their numbers, and of course it's cheaper to pay them, they produce more, so therefore they went out in economic competition. And in large part take over the economy overall. But they may not make enough more money to get all these wonderful things that you just described, which means that instead of making people richer, the school system, they make everybody poor.
Except for the
There's always a couple top people, I understand that. But normally, more than the
Right, 95%
or something.
Yeah. But you know, you have a very wealthy upper class, very small wealthy upper class, that is supported by the labor of people who make $1 a day and don't have toilets or refrigerators, and that's the way their society is structured. So if you let them onto the playing field with us and allow them to play by their version of the rules, we'll get crushed. And in information technology, we have been crushed.
And I think it's also, in a sense, work reveals a lot of the things that we really care about. And I think that's kind of going into the globalization. If you add globalization with consumerism, right, there's no real rails to put on to say, you know, why should we do these things? And it's just produce, and you need to create consumers, or you need to create people that are going to do it, and that's creating a lot of the money. So I think in a lot of times it's what is driving a lot of the growth, and how are these corporations thinking about the world? And I think it's we have a global economy, but we don't have a global government. So it's I think that's those are just some of the issues, you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I guess piggybacking on your point, I mean, is it so much a global government, or is it global rules or global values around how businesses ought to be built, right? in the new normal, right? And as I listen to your points as well, you know, it's I guess it's an unfair game, right? If you're kind of continuing with that analogy, right, as capitalism as a game. But I'm not sure if that's the right way to think about it. I guess when to some of your points about, I was really curious about how you're going to really bridge, whether we look at Christianity in business, or whether we, what some of my friends call universal law in business, and ideas around sort of, how good, intelligent, thoughtful people should build the corporations of tomorrow, right? And that, and finding the balance between sort of optimizing profits and not destroying people in the process. An interesting idea, is capitalism inherently good? Is it a reflection of the values of the society that embrace capitalism? Are there different versions of capitalism, nation to nation, people to people, community to community? Some food for thought. I could take a position on that, but...
go ahead.
I think there's a connection here somewhere, but do you see any hope in the buy local movement or initiatives that are really, I think, driven by some recognition that to go smaller, literally less distance to buy. things that are made closer to home, like that is actually valuing what it means. We're then putting our money where we think what it means to be human. Is that it actually has a connection? It reflects that more fully. Is there any hope in that? And then I see in that there's plenty of room for free market, but. Free market versus capitalism that has sort of made an, has something to say about what it means to be human. It does not jive with Christian convictions or others that would simply say let's do okay, but let's not kill people at the end of the day over this. So anyway,
And I think. I think there is some hope in that, where as much as people are, thinking through where their goods are coming from and trying to support things locally, I think, the other side of me says the world we're in is so powerful of a machine and shaping the way people think that because you have things like Amazon and you have it really comes into the kind of person you are. And I think if you throw you have capitalism, you have consumerism. There's it has inherent weaknesses that come up. It's if everyone thinks of themselves as a consumer, then they don't necessarily, are you a consumer first or are you, someone that's supporting local businesses first? And, when you're, a lot of times the way consumerism kind of shapes our minds, we just care about the things that we have and the kind of person that it makes us, not necessarily where they come from. So there has to begin to be a deprogramming that you have to kind of get out of that, but it's so powerful that it really takes, strength and wisdom and God to help us deprogram ourselves from thinking of ourselves as consumers first. And then almost connecting back to the gentleman over there, the first point, in a sense, this is a part of what John Gray was arguing. He was actually arguing, hey, America created this. And then they just stepped back and said, oh, we don't want to play anymore. Right? So he was almost speaking in some frustration where, you created the Coca-Colization of the whole world. Right? And then you'd back out like, ah, we don't want to play anymore. So, in a sense, you know, I was almost sensing the frustration in John Gray's talk, just when he's like, you know, there's complaints, but when we were on this path, it's have we just gone too far, and then we just backed out, and now we'll figure out what happens with the rest of the world. So, okay, go ahead. Then. Go ahead, Bush.
Yeah, I was part of corporate America, if you will, and then I got a couple of layoffs. I'd never been laid off before. I'm a nurse by background, and I was had drifted away from clinical nursing into kind of working in education firms, and got a couple of layoffs, and I was shocked, like, never been laid off in my life, and it kind of, all this, I got impassioned by, I don't want to be a cog in somebody else's machine. I just want to be able to do what I want to do and what I feel God placed on my heart. And so I was a nurse for really good reasons, you know, in terms of that's who I am. I'm a helper girl. I'm a sensitive person. I pick up on things. I'm practical. So that's kind of my giftedness. And so I brought that to this place that I'm still pursuing, which is marriage coaching and kind of getting in there and with people in that regard. My point really is that I don't think any child of God or child, grows up and says, I hope I could be a data processor at an Amazon facility and pack boxes. I really do. You know, we grow up with some sort of like, I'm a helper girl. I want to fight fires. I want to sit in a room and calculate, you know, chemical reactions. I want to, you know, I really see a role, you know, that we, I don't think we grow up thinking, maybe nowadays some people grow up saying, I want to consume. But I hope most people grow up saying, I want to produce and I want to contribute. Mm. And so this whole meta discussion of trends and graphs and you know, I'm just saying that I don't know that many people organically think like that. It's important to take a step back and look at the trends and figure it out and see whatever. But we really, so are we creating jobs? Are we creating work that is really about keeping everybody to have a toilet and a bathroom and a refrigerator and a whatever for the sake of? Or are we saying, what is it that you're uniquely qualified, you're uniquely touched, you're uniquely gifted to do? And if you live your whole life and you don't do that, Wendy, the world is going to be a little less light because you didn't pursue marriage coaching. You didn't get in there with people who were struggling with their marriage. Or you know what, there's a few more houses that burned to the ground because you didn't pursue that. Instead, you're in some cube doing mechanical widgets. Do you know what I mean? Like, so that's where the struggle is for me, is that God-given spark that we all have, and where does that fit in with work and trends and consumerism and global and so. It's not a question. It's
just I think.
Vomited,
Well, I think it's a great thought and something I didn't mention where there's. Like, people a lot of times say the dignity of all work. And I think in our society, we've broken things down to blue collar or white collar or, you know, this type of work versus that type of work. But I think within the Bible, we have the dignity of all work. And then I think as well, almost work as service in a sense, right? Service to God and then service to your neighbor. And then I think as well, as Christians, where who have a sense of calling a lot of times, what I say is we have to look at our industries at like a big picture and see what is my industry doing and how do I fit into that. Like, for example, me as an engineer, I kind of say, you know, we're making something of the world and trying to make people's lives easier. We're making a road or, you know, connecting people through transportation or so. Like, engineering is kind of taking the raw materials of the world, understanding how they work, and then understanding how to, you know, melt them and make them into something that's useful. And then as well as you know, you can see the same thing with like music. You're trying to take, you know, the raw material of sound and make it into something that is beautiful for someone, or like nursing, or so like, I think in a lot of the industries that people work in, looking at like the big picture of what my industry is doing, and then I would say as well, like trying to align that with who you are and who you feel that God has made you to be, right? And then there's still pitfalls in that, because I think, you know, the pitfalls there will be, a lot of times we say work is service, but work is really about ourselves, or, you know, like really pushing, or we say, you know, I'm getting into this industry because I want to make something of the world, but you're really just getting into the industry because you want to make a lot of money. And so it's like really being honest with yourself and, you know, responding to God, responding to the caller and how he made you and how he made the world. So I think, you know, there's the dignity of all work, and then there's work as service, and then kind of, I would say, looking out for the pitfalls that happen even as we begin to try to think like that. Right? So, go ahead. Oh, sorry, you were next.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
Thanks. I have a list. So for consumerism, I want to just, it's kind of anecdotal. I remember that Georgia actually brought up, on her way here, she passed by two big malls. About a month ago, I went to the mall. I hadn't been to the mall in a while. And I wasn't there to get anything. I was there to go eat. But I was waiting for my friend to go to the bathroom. And I just sat and thought about, like, the floor. There are hundreds, like, over hundreds of different items of clothing in the section. And I thought to myself, wait, what? Every season there's a turnover. Where do all these clothes go? Who buys them? And yesterday I was at the mall and I was looking at a dress. Okay, there are about 150 dresses that I could look at. Mm-hmm. And like how ingrained it is in our day to day. Going to the mall is something we all do. We go there maybe to eat, but just consumerism is kind of everywhere. Your point about globalization and how its rosiness is wearing off and you realize how different we really are. I thought about this comment you shared about how the landscape is changing, where you're like the only person, American born, even though the company went to India to reduce the cost to gain,
yeah.
You know, and how that can create tension, you know, between the two nations if, you know, there's more opportunity and they don't value, you know, they don't have the same values in terms of, they have to get the caste system, they can work and they cannot have a toilet and I don't care, but we're getting money because we deserve it.
Yeah.
And the tension that creates, I just thought that was a really great thing to point out. And then your point about the dignity of all work, thinking about, having work. And thinking about the United States, when the elections happened, my mom actually grew up in Youngstown. I have a family from Youngstown.
Wow.
And a number of them, I won't say who, voted for Trump.
Sure.
And people were like, they're black, how do they vote for Trump? They did.
They took their pen.
They did. But some of their reasoning for it was, I remember a time when, you know, my uncle or my great uncle could support a family on the job at a factory without, you know, with a high school diploma, and they saw the city go to ruin when that left, and they didn't feel like they were being heard. So just
when what left?
When the factories left Youngstown and people ran out of jobs. Just like the dignity of, I was a French teacher, and in the books it talks about globalization as like, yeah, like everyone's going to share their language and their culture and their food, but maybe everyone who's doing that already has a job, you know? Maybe everyone's there already has a job, but when you take away jobs and like basic necessities, food and being able to support a family, then people aren't as
chummy.
Yeah. And I think something I was going to mention, but I didn't get a chance to. Leading up to this, I read Dorothy Sayers' Why Work Again. And it's like she was a prophet of our age, right? Because this is just one sentence that she says. A society in which consumption has to be artificially stimulated in order to keep production going is a society founded on trash and waste. And such a society is a house built upon sand, right? And then she kind of goes on to kind of get into why work. I would suggest everybody read it. It's a very, very stimulating and challenging, you know, look at work. And the fact that she was writing it so long ago and she kind of saw, you know, a lot of these pitfalls, to me, is fascinating.
Okay, just wondering, in your research, if you've heard people who are kind of excited or hopeful for what they see as, you know, technology taking over more jobs, less work
yep.
to be done.
Yep.
All that I've really heard is that this might free us up to
yeah.
have
yep.
you know, more
yep.
genuine
yep.
relationships.
Yep.
And work is kind of taken over, and
yep.
this has come in many ways our identity,
yep.
And we no longer kind of relate to one another
yep. Yep.
The way that perhaps we should. So yep. as we see technology take over a
yep.
bit more, there's a little bit less to do, and
yep.
so we might have more free time and
yep.
to kind
yep.
of to have more genuine relationships
yep.
with one another. Is that basically what you're hearing among those who are hopeful about what they see as less work going forward?
Absolutely, right. I think there's this guy, Lawrence Katz. I think he's an economist at Harvard, and this other guy, Jeffrey Sachs, who's at Columbia. And so I would say, like, those are, like, the prophets. And there's many, many more that are almost saying what you're saying, is that we have a sick obsession for work as work's sake. And as well, and a lot of them, they make the distinction between paid and unpaid work. We have a lot of people that are doing loads and loads of unpaid work that's in the more relationship, caring professions, raising children, you know, looking after the elderly, and they're not necessarily getting compensated for it. And a lot of them are, you know, to exactly what you said, almost. I think I made the point of, like, people say, like, technology is going to do the work that we don't want to do to free us to do the work that we want to do, almost. I heard somebody say that, you know, we used to teach people to be free. Now we teach them to work. Right. And so I think there's a tension there especially with the people that feel overworked, who are workaholics and who are probably working too much and have sacrificed their relationships, their families, their marriages, their children on the altar of work, that there needs to be a rebalancing. Right. And I think that, you know, so it's almost like those people are on one side, and then the people on the other side are, well, technology is going to create more inequality, and it's going to unravel the social contract. I hate that word, but that's what people say. Like, it's going to unravel the social contract of humanity, and we're going to, you know, essentially go into a dystopia, because I firmly don't think that we've really internalized and learned how to value human life for human life's sake. So I think that's just the real problem, is that, you know, some people are, you know, we're going to talk about this next time, this universal income. Some people are championing, well, we just got to give people universal income. I'm saying, in what world? Like, and so, like, they're saying, this is what we need. As technology comes, we free up work. And they're like, you know, I when I hear that, I'm just like, that is probably never going to happen. Some people, they really champion it because we're creating so much wealth. Why not share it all? I'm like, yeah, that works so great in history.
Like free contributions to the rich.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's just, Ben, we'll go around.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, to me, that, and I haven't read any of these people that are claiming that championing technology for the ways in which it will free us up to engage in relationships. But it sounds completely naive to me, for a couple of reasons. One of which is the fact of the matter is, on the ground, technology isn't just freeing each person up a little bit so that they can have more relationships. It's some people are just losing their jobs. And that doesn't necessarily free them up to spend more time with their families.
And everybody's texting instead of talking.
And yet technology is every bit as much of a distraction from our relationships as work. So it's like, please, to lift up technology as the savior of everything is just not, you're not looking around very carefully.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
things are similar. Now, this is a definite impression, and I can't dogmatically say I'm right, but it seems to me that there's a lot less concern for the customer than there used to be, not just in stores, but like you talk to people in companies on the phones and what should I say, investments, or not just investments, all sorts of, and there's less cooperation to give the people what they want and what they need, or what they believe they need. Anyway, less concern for the customer, with the customer being brought, meaning sort of all of us, really. And also, I wanted to say I was horrified that her name, but she said she worked all her life, and she not just worked, but had a skilled job, that she had knowledge and skills, and that's contributing a lot to the society in India, the economy too. And then all of a sudden she's laid off. Will you lay off the people who are productive and helping everything else? And who, either there's no job that takes their place, or else some much lesser job that they don't do much. I'm not blaming them for not doing much, but without the skills and the abilities and the education to do it, they can't contribute. So they substitute that for someone who is skilled and contributes a lot and knowledgeable. And to me, that's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I agree.
I just wanted to say a word about the supposedly menial task that that technology is getting rid of, just I guess just to advocate for some of those things. Like I think about our experience in the community here at Woodbury and how we don't have chefs, we don't have people to clean our bathrooms or whatever. Like it's all of us who do that for each other. And there's something about being served in those ways that seem very menial, that is very relational, and working together on things that are, physical tasks that really builds relationships. And I think also one thing I've been thinking a lot about is children and the elderly. One book that I've been reading talking about this kind of automation, and I was talking to a doctor over the break between terms, and she said now a lot more things are automated for elder care, and we were just talking about, what does that mean when you're near the end of your life to not have human touch or human voice, and what if you're a child and you don't, it might seem like it's easier to automate somebody changing the diapers, but every time you change the diaper, it's telling your child that you care enough about them to do a task that you don't necessarily want to do. So I think there's something about bearing with each other through those tasks that seem like they would give us more free time to do more important things. I think those things are important and are something that even if we don't always enjoy doing it. Because I would rather hire someone else to clean their bathroom than to do it, honestly. But I think it's important. That's part of what we're talking about, service.
Yeah.
And just learning to do things we don't like.
Yeah. I totally agree with everything you said. I guess the only kicker or caveat I would say is that what a lot of the research is finding is that the quote unquote, menial jobs like cooking and cleaning, those aren't going away. Those are being added, and those are secure because a lot of, like, even if you think about gardening, for example, it's hard to codify that because it's like even though there are some repeatable steps, it's hard to tell the technology, I want red and green and blue flowers and I want tomatoes over here. So it's like, like that. So like a lot of what they're seeing is that, cooking, cleaning, gardening, and some of the quote unquote, like being a barber, like some of the menial tasks, those are the ones that are not going away. Those are the ones that are secure. The only danger is, and this will be a lot of part two, is like people say just the speed and artificial intelligence. And so it's like, how long will that be? Like, I think there's a, I forgot which company it is, but they're actually working on a robot that will clean your house, right? That's kind of, you know, I don't know how far along they'll get to it, because, you know, a lot of the technology and the artificial intelligence, you know, it's not there yet, but they're almost saying, you know, they said that for self-driving cars, and now look. So it's interesting to keep following.
Yeah, that's some of the things around these things with children and
yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Interested in your question about should society responsible for sort of advocating for work? I found that to be a really interesting question. And I agree with you, yes. I mean, for the same reason that human beings are made to work.
Yeah.
That's how we flourish. And yet, to me, the most discouraging thing is just that we live in a society that elevates efficiency above all other things, because it's, you know, a higher profit. The more efficient you are, the faster you can get things done. And the ways in which so much human work is replaceable by technology and made way more efficient.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how do we... seems to be that there has to be some sort of massive cultural shift in terms of how we understand human beings to make a convincing case that it's worth being less efficient.
Yeah.
For people to work, you know? Like, how do you sell that one?
it's like that point that you make, you know, I've, you know, I guess that's kind of what pushed me to the question, because it's, and I think that's why I was saying what's the value that we place on human beings, and are human beings worth it? And I don't know how popular you would be in investment banking boardrooms. You know, like...
Sure.
Yeah. It's because I've been trying to think of how to... Especially where, like, you know, spreadsheets are so impersonal, right? So it's like, if you just talk profit and loss, well, whose profit is that and whose losses?
Right.
Right? And it's, you know... yeah, I mean...
And the company has to stay afloat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
Can't just be inefficient all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel a little bit to what Sarah was saying a minute ago. Just the whole sort of craft, handmade economy.
Mm.
Yes.
Is really interesting, because it's you know, and you know, many people who don't necessarily have any religious faith, but recognize that you're connecting with something deeply human that's being lost. When you make something unique with your hands and sell it to somebody who actually wants and values it because it was made by a human being and couldn't have been mass produced. And so people are willing to pay more money knowing that, you know, their local, you know, potter made their set of plates, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and that to me is hopeful, but not necessarily on a massive scale, right?
Yeah.
And to be able to afford the handmade set of plates, you can't be a potter yourself. You got to be doing something else. Right? And so, to me, it's exciting and hopeful. I mean, you know, on these little microcosm kind of levels, like, you know, even craft breweries and all these little, like, the commitment to buying something that you know you couldn't have gotten at Walmart.
Right?
You can't. It's too well made and. I don't know, but I want to applaud that as recognizing something important about human beings, right?
Yeah. And I think as well, it's you know, to the point, the only thing that, or at least not, it's something that I've been thinking about is trying to balance, right? Because there's strength to quote-unquote capitalism, but then there are also weaknesses that we just don't really hear about or talk about, right? Because in a sense, I think this was in The Call, by Oz Guinness. He has a chapter on like money and capitalism, and he's saying that he was saying that the capitalism's grave digger thesis, because as you are prudent and you get the flourishing and the money, right, now you don't, once you have it, you have to have the disciplines to not waste it and then lose it all. So he's almost, and he's, and I think he's, you know, referring a lot to, I heard Dick talk about this in his ambition, Cotton Mather, the, like the two oars, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, money, so as far as you make it well, and then you use it well, but then as you get it, and the overabundance, a lot of times, you become drunk with it, and the things that you needed to make it, the disciplines that you put in place, you just lose them, because you almost get lost in the abundance, and then you end back up in the same place, right? And like, even thinking through the meaning of money, like, what does it mean, and the dangers, like the dangers of it, because so many, I mean, for me, I find this surprising in the Gospels, like Jesus talked about it so much. He's almost trying to get people to see the danger of it and like to help them to be freed of it almost in a sense. But I think, in my mind, I think finding a way to talk about those two things in our society today could potentially be helpful. Thank you, man.
Yeah, no, so to pick up on my buddy's point, so buying local, right? So you see a lot of that in Brooklyn big time, right? And just the excitement around brands that you feel are connected to people, right? And we're attracted to brands on the basis of some, you know, human authenticity, which I thought was very, very interesting, but in also making the case for society to be an advocate of jobs, I think there's something to be said for making the case for society being advocates of education, right? That really asks the big questions to children early on,
yeah,
on what they want to be, right? And what they want to do, and how they can best contribute to society, right? All while staying true to who the children are, right? And I'm not as versed in the Bible as you are, but perhaps there's an idea in there somewhere that suggests that, that everyone has a gift, right? And everyone has a, something unique about them, right? That can be optimized, right? For communal benefit, right? So those are ideas that are consistent, right? With capitalism, and consistent with big profitable companies, right? So how do we think through the future of education in preparing us for the future of work? That's I guess kind of the big question. I guess, yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Or
yeah,
well, have some channel on that. Yeah.
I was thinking this in response to your comment too about the spark inside people, and I wonder if we ask kids too soon what you want to be, what you want to do, before they even have an imagination for what's possible. Mm-hmm. And one of my concerns is that what they're seeing in the realm of what the options are is so intangible. You know, like it's not concrete. Like my dad has been making furniture for 35 years and has made a living doing that, like against all odds. He is just not on board with anything to do with technology, and it survived, you know. And so like the possibility of making something for your living was part of my upbringing, and I knew many people who did that, but they worked harder than anybody I've ever met. And you know, but like, what, and I think about that for my kids, like, what are they seeing in us and in the other adults in their lives as options for work? And so I just wonder. Yep. to this woman's point of, are the people they know actually like Amazon data processors, and you know how? How do we fill our children's imaginations with what's possible to start with, and then ask them, what do you want to be? We've been talking some too about the way that kids have a lot of respect when they see adults doing hard things, and it's been a really good prompt for us to think like, what hard things, you know, that would compute as a hard thing in the mind of an almost 7-year-old? Does my son see us doing? You know, like, we don't change the oil in our car. You know, we make our meals. You know, that, like, we wield a knife, a kitchen knife. You're dealing with chopping wood, different, you know, I don't know, like, things that are really concrete for an almost 7-year-old. Like, oh, you can do hard things. But I think that something as simple as that is less and less a part of children's experience in growing up, too. Like, what are the hard things that our kids see us do? Or how do they see us tackling those hard things? You know, and I think, to your point about automating diaper changing, if my child just hear me like, or is there something, you know, if not like enjoying the diaper changing itself, like the face-to-face, the relational, you know, which I think there is that, but... So both, like, what are they seeing us do that's hard? And then what are we modeling in our attitude toward what's hard? What's in the realm of possibility?
Yeah. Yes, okay.
Oh, yeah, you said something earlier that made me think of this, about what are children aspiring to be and what, you know, what are they looking forward to doing with their lives? You know, so I'm a millennial, if it's not really evident, but a lot of my friends and colleagues are entrepreneurs, and they just have, you know, side businesses, not necessarily in the quote-unquote gig economy that's very tech-savvy, tech-oriented, but, you know, they do photography, or they do business consultation, or they're baking, or something of that nature. But then I also thought, we're having this conversation in isolation of actual culture and society, right? So what else is happening besides the gig economy right now? And that's like having a personality as a brand, having a reality TV show as like your primary form of income just to exist and get paid to show people that you exist. And what does that really mean? You know, what direction could we possibly go that's positive with that kind of growing, right? There's so many shows about just, whether it's really reality or not, whatever, whether it's scripted or not, but there are just so many shows portraying quote-unquote reality that people are getting paid for, right? And a lot of young people are trying to find their ways into that. They have shows that target young people specifically, like My Super Sweet 16, right? So now, not only was it not enough to have a Sweet 16, now it has to be, like, bigger than most people's weddings, right? Mm-hmm. Or promposal. This kills me. But, like, you're not getting married. But that's a thing now. And so it's like young kids, they almost have very limited, you know, perspectives and options as to, you know, how they can make a career or a livelihood the way that our society and our culture is going with what we glorify and with what we reward monetarily. And then I had a list of questions that I texted you if you want to read any of them. One thing that came up was whether I heard a lot of, we do this technology work so that we can do the work we want to do, or so that we have more time to do the things we want to do. And that kind of was married to this idea of, in my head, not necessarily that someone presented it this way, but of like caring for the elderly, things that you, like if I'm caring for my grandmother, I don't need someone to compensate me for that, right? But then I heard, well, you're doing free work. It's uncompensated work. Is all work worthy of compensation, or is it not worthy? Does all work warrant monetary compensation? Is monetary compensation the only compensation that we would feel validates the work that we do? Yeah, I'll leave that one. That's the only one I'll ask. And I have to go. Otherwise, I would stay to hear the rest.
Thanks. Sorry. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, well, shameless plug for part two. Part two, we're going to look at education quite a bit. But, you know, a lot of people are saying the way we do education now, the way that we've modeled it, it's a lot of memorization and kind of you're spitting back out what you've been taught, and that's what we, how we educate people. And surprisingly, that is what a lot of people say that machines are good at, you know, taking in data, processing it, and giving it back. And so they're, you know, kind of thinking through education that validates creativity, thinking through education that almost allows people to be creative, thinking about education in different ways. And then also a lot of, like, thinking about re-education, and also thinking about flexibility, because, like, in a lot of careers, right, if you go back and take the exams for your career that you've been in for 25 years, you might not pass, right? Because it's like you just get in this career and then this is kind of, you're just on that path. But like almost, you know, people say education is a lifelong journey, but very few actually mean it, right? So it's like some of those ways of being and living and thinking when it comes to education. And I also think, you know, as far as sometimes we have to be practical, and we need money to survive, so you have to go do what you have to do to get that. And then as well with keeping an eye on your calling and kind of who you feel like you're called to be. So there might have to be times of that balance where I have to, and as well as just like kind of, you know, thinking through kind of who you are and how that fits. And if you're blessed to monetize that, great. But if you're not, you can still do that while, you know, working and earning money and, you know, surviving. So I think that a lot of those ways of thinking are just what we're going to have to do just because of the way that the world is going. I don't remember what her second question was now that she's gone. I think we can move on, but I don't remember. Does anyone remember what it was?
What do you mean by re-education?
Meaning, like, a lot of times when people's fields are, it becomes obsolete, they got to go back to school, they got to do X, Y, and Z. So just kind of, you know, just kind of continuing that process of re-education. So.
Just ask, with the progression of robotics every day, mm-hmm. more things are being computerized. Where are the people who are left out? Their jobs because of this. Where are they going?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the million-dollar question right now, because it's a combination of re-education. It's a combination of, I think we're going to have to be more creative in, you know, thinking through ways to assist people through the transition. Because I think...
And transition to what? Because the machines are going to be there.
And
at some point, you're going to have a situation where you're going to have more and more people impoverished by the evolution.
Yeah.
And you're going to have, we've seen this before, with the new life movements.
Yeah.
You're going to have major focus.
Yeah.
In society.
Yeah. I think, for me, I think those are the challenges that we're going to have to begin to really think through, like, we might have to rethink, you know, how we tax, right? Today, we tax labor, not production, for example. Or, you know, if you create jobs, you're paying the government a lot of money, you know? So we might have to tax the things that we want less of and incentivize the things we want more of, right? And so I think it's going to really, it's going to take policymakers to also really get involved and think critically. I think it's also going to take, sometimes people say race against the machine. I think it's safe enough to say if you're trying to be better at machines than what, if you're trying to be better at machines than at what machines do, you're probably going to lose. So it's, we should probably say we're going to have to race with the machine. And then I think it's, we're probably also going to have to ask the deeper philosophical questions of, you know, more and more we can't ignore it, of just, you know, what is this all for? And where is it going at the end of the day? Because a lot of times that is, people just aren't engaging with those questions because they don't have time for it. So it's this, you know, we have ends, like, is technology an end or a means? And if it's a means to what? So I think that those are, someone with the voice and the influence just has to be really asking a lot of those questions in creative ways, right? Maybe through, like, we need artists to start creating music and songs and poems that are forcing people to engage with these questions, even if they don't want to. Looks like that's all for the evening. Thanks everybody for coming.
Well, I know.
Yeah.
True.